This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan and PK Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
And we also have BFM's very own Sharad Kutan.
Oh, always a pleasure to be here.
One of the founding fathers of a bit of culture.
Absolutely. I was there at the birthing.
That's right. And your
My legs are spread.
Your face. But now your face is on the Mount Rushmore.
And I don't spread for anybody, generally.
Well, welcome to New Malaysia. And our three topics this week will be, topic number one is happy endings. Topic number two is internet arguments. And topic number three is picture-perfect royals. So, Uma, happy endings.
Yes. So I think this new Malaysia, these post-GE14 mood has affected all of us in very, very different ways. There's been a sense of euphoria for a lot of the public, and I was looking at how it's affected the kind of work that I do, especially with literary and film criticism, right? And I've been seeing a lot of movies since that happened, and somehow I've been drawing new parallels and seeing these movies in different lights. And Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs is a brand new movie that's coming out. It opens in cinemas soon, and essentially it's about a group of dogs. They're stop-motion animation. They've been dumped on this place called Trash Island by a corrupt Japanese mayor of a fictional city called Megasaki, right? So the dog adventure story is one, but there's a parallel plot that's about political corruption. The political corruption plot is something we'll all be very, very familiar with because it plays out like it does in many real-life dictatorships or corrupt body politics, right? Essentially, there is corruption, there is the oppression of voices, and then all of that comes to a head where, you know, the bad guy is overthrown and the good guys win. Hurrah! Now, we've seen this play out in film many, many times. However, when watching Isle of Dogs after the events of GE14, it triggered something in my brain because it was somewhat of a refreshing change, because usually that third act plot point in which the good guys win, the person running the school newspaper, standing up against the politically corrupt villain, actually gets his or her way, that has always been a fantasy to us. Now it's not. Right? At least for the moment, it isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows what's going to happen in six months? But at least for the moment, it isn't. And so I found that this greatly affected my viewing experience in that.
Tears in your eyes, wasn't it?
Well, I enjoyed this movie maybe a lot more than I should have. I don't know. So my co-host Ian was somewhat lukewarm to this film. He said it's not one of Wes Anderson's best, but I left the cinema going, my God, this is one of his best works.
Because he's Irish. You know, so what does he know?
What does he know, right?
Hopey change.
Hopey changey stuff, yeah. But so I found that was really, really weird. And I was wondering if any of you had experienced this where you've read things or seen things recently and you've drawn unfortunate parallels with everything that's been going on and it's affected you differently. Because, let's be fair, all three of us in this room are very cynical liberals.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I think I've always had a very strong optimistic streak. I think that if you kind of read history, especially in the 20th century, it's always been a mixed bag, right? So the triumphs can sometimes go sour, you know, and losses can be turned into victories in the long run because, you know, unintended consequences, as it were. So, you know, there's always a nuance. There's always gray in the picture. And I'm no real fan of the Milagro Beanfield War type movies, though,
right,
because they are so feel good and because they lack what I've always felt is the dose of reality we need to get us off our bums. What I would like us to do at the end of a movie is to feel a lack of satisfaction. In fact, what the movie ought to do is not provide
you, right?
Not provide you the catharsis, but in fact to withhold that so that then you go out into the world and perform that.
Which is what this movie would have done about 10 days ago. Right, uh-huh. Because you see it happen and you're like, well, that's never happening for us. But it's given me a new resolve, right, that the common man can stand up for good. And now I'm just thinking, well, let's go have a coffee.
I would love to see Sharad be put in charge of Disney Studios.
Why? Well, first of all, I would decline the offer.
Those movies would be like, you know, like The Bicycle Thieves, you know, the most depressing movies of
no,
all time.
You know, I grew up on things like Pollyanna and what. I think it's very important to the start of somebody's development as a human being, to give them those positive stories, the stories of redemption.
And then
and all
take
that.
It away when they learn how to read and write.
Yeah, yeah. By the time they're 8, they really should be graduating from that.
Yeah.
Then again, maybe it's just us, right? Maybe we're just so inside this moment because of the work we do that everything we see, it's like we watch Avengers and we're like, oh my God, Thanos is Najib. You know, maybe that's what we're seeing everywhere.
Well, certainly, I mean, by trolling social media, I mean, there is a mood of hope and optimism sweeping certainly liberal, middle class Kuala Lumpur. I would say my equivalent would be slightly different, which is that I found myself watching things, which I probably would have watched before anyway, but I found myself being able to enjoy it for its own sake, as opposed to watching it with a view to escaping from the horrors around me.
And can I say, this is a very different Kam Raslan from a year and a half ago when Trump won and you were shunning everything. You were like, ah, television's bad, the internet's horrible, everything's reminding me that the world's a terrible place.
Because Uma Paganam Kevagan told me he will never, ever win. And I was like, but Uma said...
But Uma said he would never win.
Never win. So,
You know, what is really amazing is that people outside of Malaysia will be reading us in ways that conforms to the story they want.
They
so
want
their narratives, right? So if you look at the people in Thailand today struggling to have an election to restore democracy in that country, or in Indonesia at this point in time celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of Suharto and saying, what did we do wrong in those early days? And, you know, will the Malaysians make the same mistakes?
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because the story of democracy and the fight for democracy is not unique to Malaysians all around the region, maybe not even in Singapore, but that's a special case.
Yeah.
But there you have it.
No, I was just going to say, Cam, there's a line at the very end of this Wes Anderson film, which I think speaks to what we're all feeling. They were talking about this new rise for Megasaki because, you know, the corruption is gone. I mean, the evil dictator is gone, right? And essentially there was a line saying, well, now corruption and political graft can go back to acceptable levels.
Mm. Yeah. And you know, let's check back with Uma in a year or so and see.
Maybe in a week.
Okay. So I'm going to move away, I think, radically, perhaps, from the post-general election for the first time on A Bit of Culture for a few weeks. And I want to talk about arguing on the internet. See, I'm feeling a bit sheepish at the moment because I just got involved in an internet argument.
Woohoo!
And I got completely bested. I got trashed. But it was my fault. It was because I misunderstood the premise of the argument. It had not been laid out clearly.
Was this the first time you got into an internet-based argument?
I try so hard to never, ever get involved.
Same here. I try to avoid them.
Yeah, me too. But except I go on Twitter and then have my rants and then, of course.
Well, that's the question I want to ask. It's like, can one ever win or have a fulfilling experience, an enjoyable moment, a learning moment, whatever, but attempting to argue on the internet? Because it's so unnatural. I mean, arguments really should happen, discussions should happen face-to-face, where your vocal intonation...
The vocal tone, exactly.
Vocal tone, because I've discovered that, you know, I use sarcasm so much in speaking.
But you can avoid it. If you craft the language such and you take on the terms, you define the terms more clearly, you can have an argument or a discussion on Twitter or Facebook, whether for which the issue of tone isn't crucial or fatal.
Yes, but both parties have to be willing to put in that kind of effort to make sure that it's very clear what they're saying. So, I mean, in this instance, the premise was just not clear. After going back and forth and back and forth, I went back to it and I thought, oh, hang on a second, I misread that. And so I've ended up looking like a complete idiot.
And did you concede openly to
that? Yeah, I said, you know, I'm sorry. But when I understood the premise, I still thought he was wrong.
Well, you see,
but
this
in
is
a different way. But I could no longer say anything.
You're very gracious in that way for accepting.
It wasn't
apology. You know, because most people don't. They just they just descend into a kind of spiral. And then what they'll do is they'll throw a little heading or they will go off on a tangent just to make sure that they win the argument, right? So, yeah, you know, you're very mature, Cam. I'm shocked.
No, I agree. I think that's what happens, Cam, in the sense that it's not possible. You know, we talk about Twitter and Facebook allowing us new platforms for discourse and discussion. It's very rare that we actually have what can be considered discourse and discussion. A lot of the time it's epistemic violence, right? Someone is shouting you down for something. And that's what usually happens. I mean, if someone feels passionate enough to get involved in the argument, it usually means they've decided on their side. And what I see on Twitter, the 280 characters being a limiting factor, that's one. Also, you're facing down with someone who's really passionate about something and maybe is not
clear,
willing to change their mind based on the virtue of a good argument.
It used to be 140 characters.
Which is even harder.
Yeah, but it was good because I think what I love about Twitter, and you can follow me at Sharad Kutin, you know, and I'm catching up with these two gentlemen, but you can follow me on Twitter.
Get on with it, Sharad
Kutin. Is that, you know, if you craft it well,
yes,
you can take people along a very interesting journey about the terms of our debates, in our feelings.
You can.
And you can take a measure where the country is going. I mean, your little slice of the country.
Yes, but it's very rare. I think I've been on Twitter now for almost a decade, and I think I've probably, like, when it comes to like proper arguments where I've learned something from it and not just have someone call me names after about 10 tweets, maybe happened 3 times, 4 times. That's about it. Most of the time, people will either make a sucky comment or get really angry at you for something. Mm.
Well, I think that what it's good for is declamatory, to make statements. And you read it and you can take it on board and you can...
And the people who agree with you will retweet and like it. And the people who disagree with you will call you out.
The statements are something that can help you on your journey, whether you agree or not. But I think that then trying to jump into a discussion is impossible because...
Wait, but what you can do, though, I mean, I use Twitter polls a lot, and I think that's very interesting because I can frame a thought that I have and turn it into a Twitter poll and get a measure of people's response to my thoughts. Or I can genuinely try and solicit their sense of where this is going by having a very open poll. And I know it's very limited. You know, my 4,500 and X number of followers...
Follow him on @Chirag.
Please follow him on @Chirag.
Or he won't shut up. Is that, you know, it's a small part of the Twitter universe, but it is an interesting, because they're quite engaged.
No, so it's a very self-selecting crowd. I mean, these are the people who have chosen to follow Chirag Kutan.
Except that when I put out polls where I expect people who are like in, you know, the kind of liberal mold that I'm in to vote the way I vote. And I find that there are people who don't. And so then I think, oh, there are people who are in my Twitterverse who are not like me.
Right. So you find them, you follow them home, and you...
shake them.
Well, yeah. So in conclusion then...
Okay, so if we were going to give something prescriptive for people, I don't know. I mean, I always try... So I never try to get into these arguments where I'm taking someone out for the sake of it, where if someone... post something that I feel is stupid, I often try an engaging tone rather than a tweet going, look at this moron, which is what most people do. And I find that that probably works best because even if someone has made a mistake, like you did, it's best to engage with the person as opposed to going, well, Cam, you're an idiot and you don't know anything, because that just puts your defenses up, right? And you never have a good conversation after that.
Yeah, well, I am an idiot. because also when you're trying to get involved in an argument, it's because... you want to press your own sense of superiority. I was really showing off. And as I was typing, it was like, I'm just being so damn clever here. And then it was only later when I realized, I don't even understand the English language, that I felt so foolish because I wanted to show my intellectual powers.
Well, you know, this is very interesting because I have long stopped being passionate in that way with those debates on internet. I'm very distant from those debates. It means I'm not emotionally involved. I mean, sometimes I get a bit, but I always try to check myself. I think the idea is to be really dispassionate, to view this as an opportunity to get a sense of the world, but not really the place for changing the world. I don't think Twitter is the place change will come from. So therefore, my investments are much more modest.
Right, right. But then also, you have no soul. Sure, as we ascertained in part one of this.
That being said, it's also fun sometimes to just troll the naughty people.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So should one get involved in Twitter argument? Poll yes, no?
Only if you're not invested in it.
Okay.
I say just leave it alone.
Yeah, me too. I say leave it alone. So in a moment, though, we're going to return with something, well, I should think much happier. Picture Perfect Royals here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Parkin, Amke Parkin, and Sharad Kutan. And now, Sharad, Picture Perfect Royals.
Okay, so what the rustling of paper here is from a piece. It's actually the Financial Times, a life and arts section. And it's a piece by Simon Sharma about the recent Harry and Meghan
Sharma writing about the royal wedding. Yes, so fantastic.
But should we just say who Simon Sharma is?
So Simon Sharma is a well-known writer, cultural critic,
historian,
so on and so forth. And I must admit, you know, this is as close as I've gotten to the royal wedding. I did not watch it over the weekend. I have not engaged in much Googling of the people behind it.
You're too cool, Sharad.
Harry, there was one scandal where he was kind of butt naked doing something to some girl, and that was splashed with some American tabloid. But apart from that...
You know nothing about Harry.
Mr. Ginger. Well, what I do know about Harry was that his mother was involved in one of the most... photographed, filmed. There wasn't Twitter then, but, you know, Diana Spencer, when she married Harry's father, whose name I kind of forget at this point in time. That was a spectacle that I watched. I watched that.
Yeah.
And I watched it for all kinds of reasons. Now, what Simon Sharma's argument is, and it's not, you know, trashy tabloid type of article, he's just saying that the royals of Britain have been for several hundred years now trying to manage their image. And they're trying to manage their image dealing with this rather serious paradox, which is that they need to maintain the mystique of the royal family. At the same time, they cannot become invisible. So there is a sweet spot between invisibility and the mystique and too much visibility.
Yeah.
And of course, there was a time when, and this was the time of the reign of Elizabeth, where, not the current Elizabeth, the former Elizabeth, and they use oil paintings. But now in the time of the internet and photography and so forth, there is a kind of inherent danger that you're going to be slipping. And of course, it's been slipping for some time now. But these moments are extraordinary in sealing again the mystique of the royals as an important part of any culture, of some cultures, and so on and so forth. So it's a fascinating historical context on this fun little festival that everybody around the world has been able to enjoy.
Did Simon Sharma conclude that it was a successful venture in Brand Windsor?
Well, he ends with a question. And the question is, if Harry and Meghan are able to snatch something of real romance and genuine love amidst this whole, you know, very stage-managed spectacle, then maybe it was worth it. And because he does mention in British history...
It's a very sentimental note to end on. It's quite nice,
He mentions the relationship between Victoria and her husband.
Is it, Albert.
Yeah, so that was apparently... I'm not British, so I don't...
There's a museum named after them.
Royal Albert Hall and so on and so forth. Well, so there was apparently another moment of genuine love.
Right.
But it always often goes bad. And of course, with Harry, his mother represents one of those subplots, right?
Well, so here's the interesting thing, which I found with this and the difference with what you're talking about, the mystique. When Diana got married, right, and what's interesting about that royal wedding was she was the outsider coming in, and, you know, there was an added mystique on the part of, it was kind of like, you know, on the part of the public, because they got to witness, there was no social media, but they still got to witness this royal spectacle with this commoner getting married and all the trials and tribulations she had to go through to enter this royal household. But with the Harry and Meghan one, it feels so much more like Hollywood celebrity more than anything else. And I think that was the big distinction I felt. You know, sure, Idris Elba, George Clooney, David Beckham all kind of show up. But the global reaction... Yeah, they did. But the global reaction to this...
You watched this spectacle?
I didn't. I was just following on Twitter.
I did.
You watched it? Okay.
Wait, did you have, like, goosebumps? Were you, like, moved to tears at any point?
No, I was not. But, I mean, it was visually very impressive. It really was.
And so for me, the accessibility is something different. In the past, it was inaccessible because they were blue bloods. They were royals. They were something that we common folk could never touch. This feels like a different level of accessibility. Like, oh, look, you know, we'll never live like George Clooney. That's the Hollywood. This one felt more Hollywood than blue blood.
Yeah.
So does that make sense?
That could be me
there. No, maybe you go to and then on a casting couch have your fate sealed, you know,
not Ursula.
No, sure.
Maybe not you and me.
No, sure.
But unfortunately, Harvey Weinstein will have many stories of
that's
how
a good
he's
point.
He sealed the future of many.
You can make snide comments about it, but I think we have to say though that they have actually, the British royals have been incredibly successful in saving and promoting themselves through some really difficult moments. Not just in the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, but over hundreds of years. I mean, there were really powerful Republican moments along the way.
Well, you know, and so Thai royals also another study in public relations.
Yeah.
They too employed photography. They too, you know, with the help of the CIA, put out calendars of the king across the nation in the 60s during the Cold War.
Yes, but you know, what you're trying to do, I think, is to simply sort of like dismiss it or denounce it. But I think it's an opportunity to look at a very successful project.
Yeah, I think what Simon Sharma is saying, I mean, he's saying it is been one of their tools, despite things, you know, tearing at the seams, they've managed to keep it together. I'm not invested in their success or failure as an institution. It was very interesting if you remember what happened to the royals of Nepal.
Yes.
Because after many hundreds of years, shut away by this hereditary prime ministership, who kept the royals there kind of secluded and important, but in a very limited way. And then when the royals came out, they just fell apart. They killed each other.
It was a massacre.
The sun came out and massacre. And so that became another spectacle. And I think it's very interesting to see where the institutional, because it's a throwback to a different time. The question is, how do you keep
upgrading, right?
Yeah, how do you survive it?
I don't know if it is a throwback to a different time. It's perhaps a throwback to a visual. There are so many different visual stories happening in that. There is the Hollywood aspect that Uma's mentioning. Also the fact that she really is very much a commoner.
Diana Spencer?
No, she was Lady Diana Spencer. Yes, so she was theoretically a commoner, but she's like way more posh than anybody
you've ever met. Yeah, she's posh, but she was a school teacher and she was a kindergarten teacher.
That bright.
Who looked exactly like Catherine Oxenberg.
Yeah. But this Meghan Markle, I mean, the only member of her family in attendance was her mother.
Correct.
The only single person who was there on her side. I mean, that's astonishing in itself. And her mother's a black American. And, all these different stories happening. So I think that
the last time someone married an American, they had to give up the throne.
Well, yeah. It's a throwback. But it's also the Windsors portraying an image that's actually a leap forwards. And I was watching it. The British are always really good at putting on these spectacles.
Right. So the thing is not the message, but the fact that it is stage managed. And I think that's what Simon Chalmers is saying.
Yeah, very cleverly.
Right. So how they stage manage it, and the fact that it stretched back to the time of portraiture, and that, you know, the time of Elizabeth, it was portraiture that put Elizabeth out there, even when she was failing to produce an heir for the throne, but it was important to have everybody know her in some sense. Mm. So she wasn't hidden from view.
Yeah. Well, now they're theoretically sort of out in the open. But anyway, so I did watch it and I thought it looked amazing. Neither of you two did.
No, I was following on Twitter. But it's interesting though, because for me, it's funny, the British royals are so good at this, and yet British politicians are so horrible at this.
Terrible.
Stage managing, and the British politics is the worst. Like, worst. Their PR game is so bad.
Yeah, the whole Brexit thing, and then suddenly there's this ray of sunshine.
Because they have to do it on a daily basis,
whereas
the royals need to trot out these occasions.
It's spectacles, right?
Once in a while. So anyway, Sherrod's obviously not convinced, but...
I wish Harry and Meghan all the best, okay? If you're listening in, let me tell you, I wish you the best. I'm looking forward to those many offspring that might populate the throne one day.
Okay.
If you can displace your brother and his offspring.
All right. So, but now we move on from the royals to final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something you think might be of interest, and Uma goes first.
Right, I go first. So I bought a book recently called How to Read Nancy. So remember the Nancy comic strip?
No.
There's a very famous comic strip called Nancy.
Producer Ali is
No, okay. So it was either in the style of the NSD. It's still there. It's been running from the time I was a kid. It's probably running from the time since you guys were kids. It's a very famous comic strip. But what's cool about this book is it's actually a study on the art of creating comic strips. Mm. And it's this wonderful, wonderful book where they take Nancy as a template. They remove all the structural elements and they step you through everything that makes a simple black and white comic strip so effective. It is phenomenal. So it's a pretty big book because they go through all these various elements of scripting, of artwork, of messaging in the background, and all of this stuff. It is actually written, I'm just looking it up now because I forgot the name of the author, but the author will come back and I'll let you know where it is. Paul Karasik is the name of the author. And it's wonderful. So even if you know nothing about Nancy the comic strip, you've definitely read 3 and 4 panel comic strips in newspapers before, and this one kind of sheds a new light as to the genius behind how difficult it is to actually make something effective, funny, poignant, affecting in such a simple form.
Oh, Deadpool. I love Deadpool.
Oh, you watched Deadpool too, did you?
Both. I've watched both and I love it.
Really? I didn't like the first one.
On Netflix, I actually like the first one better. But Netflix has something called Happy, which is a great show. I would recommend it to everybody.
Sherrod, you're going completely off point. We're talking about...
I thought we're done with you.
No, we're done with my show.
No, that's...
Time. We're running out of time.
We need to find... So what's it called again?
It's called How to Read Nancy. Uh-huh. It's by Paul Karasik. Mm-hmm. And it's... Yeah, it's just if you like comic strips and you want to know more about how they're made, because everyone looks at it and it looks so simple, right? And it's not.
Oh, I must check it out. Sounds
okay, now the Ministry of Education, no longer to produce those books about how not to be a Nancy boy.
That's in the new Malaysia. That is not this comic. Yes.
That's a different kind of Nancy. So my recommendation is related to what we were mentioning earlier. I mentioned earlier how I found myself watching things for the pure enjoyment of it and enjoying things.
What was that like?
It was just such fun. And so I just want to recommend a little 5-minute thing on YouTube, which is outtakes from The Muppets on how...
I've seen this. Is it the one with the door and the bale running out?
The drum rolling.
The drum rolling out, yeah. Yes.
And I mean, if you just Google search for Muppets outtakes, and it's from... I forgot.
Christmas Carol.
Christmas Otter... Anyway, you look it up. Outtakes Muppets. And it's just very funny. It's just 5 minutes of a thing where they were trying to shoot something very simple, and it took 233 takes. But the genius of the Muppets people, Jim Henson, Frank Oz, was that little hand puppet keeping in character, two little hand puppets keeping in character throughout the whole thing, and just being so funny as they just got more and more desperate to make this thing work. And I just enjoyed it so much.
I grew up in The Muppets.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So I've watched it many times, and I loved it.
Yeah, so there's actually a documentary series as well, a documentary movie, which you can watch. I think it's just called People Talking About Muppets, and essentially all of these guys sat down in a room, Frank Oz, all the original guys who did Sesame Street and Jim Henson and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
And it's just them sitting in a room talking about their experiences.
It must be a long time ago. Jim Henson's been dead for...
Oh, no, Jim Henson wasn't there, but all the people who'd worked for Jim Henson. So this just came out about a month ago.
Oh, my God. Yes. Let's watch that.
I've got a copy. I'll lend it to you. I was one of these pre-order people, so I have a DVD that's signed by Frank Oz.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'd also recommend just check out the movies of Frank Oz. He's a great director.
He is.
Little Shop of Horrors.
He's done quite a bit.
Quite a lot. They're Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and a whole bunch. He's a really good director. So that's the Muppets outtakes. I thought it was so funny. It tears in my eyes.
Okay, Sherrod. That's just 5 minutes long. So I'm going to suggest something that's, I think, 6 hours long on Netflix called Wild, Wild Country. And it's the documentary on the commune in Oregon that was centered around Bhagwan Rajneesh. He was kind of a Maharishi teacher, cult leader in India. Also known as Osho in his later incarnation. And it's a story really more about the people around him, in particular a woman, a very young Indian woman who became the force behind creating the commune and realizing his dream. Why he puts her in charge at such a tender age, why he had such tremendous faith in her, and how she was able to rally and mobilize people is just an extraordinary portrait of a woman's power. Never mind anything else.
And she's an amazing character to watch.
She is.
Over the 6 episodes, your feelings for her, the way they change. Initially, you think she's the villain of the piece. And as you're watching, they change episode to episode. You're just like, I love you. I hate you. What is going on? Right? Yeah. And she's done some nasty things.
Yeah. And it was a curious time because there are also people that the documentary speaks to who are true believers and remain true believers. And you could see it in even in their slight criticism, acknowledgement of the problems that went wrong, their tears in their eyes.
Yeah.
Because what Bhagwan represented, and I say it as if I'm a cult follower, what the Bhagwan represented was a dream of a better world, you know, and a new type of relationship.
But no, have you read the Osho stuff? Because so here's the thing.
No, I haven't.
I think he was genuinely a genius of some sort. And I think more people would have followed him. I've read some of his writings and very smart, very progressive. And I think more people would have been accepting of it if it weren't for the free sex stuff. The free sex stuff put off a lot of conservative religious individuals.
That
right?
Maybe the free sex, I think, was the least of the problem. It was his avarice and his love of bling.
Yes.
So he had, I don't know, how many Rolls
15
Royces.
15 Rolls Royces, yeah.
You know, he would, and this was his downfall. He could be very easily bought over and flattered through gifts of, you know, of expensive gifts or diamond-studded watch. These were the things this man who was talking about the new world and a new man was very susceptible to. So that was a great contradiction in his personality.
Yeah. The one thing the documentary doesn't really address, which I've always been fascinated by and I haven't found a real read on it, is these individuals. Like the people, everyone who meets him, they see him and within seconds they're in love. Like, they just like, oh my God, I was in awe of this individual. And he hasn't said anything to them, right? And you see the same thing with our Teapot Kingdom guy. And you see the YouTube videos of him.
Ayapin,
going to temples, Indian temples. And people are just immediately just falling at his feet. There's something about these individuals that seem to command
aura,
that kind of
charisma.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's crazy.
But I guess that his story in India, back in India, is probably very, very different.
No, it involved pretty much. I mean, he had already built a bit of an empire in India,
but not of that free sex stuff though in India.
Yes,
oh, it was there.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's why Indira Gandhi's government tried to get rid of him.
Oh my God!
Yeah, he had a problem with the Maharashtra state. But actually, that's not the fascinating stuff. I mean, it's really portraits of people that you're seeing in this documentary.
All right, so that's Wild Wild Country.
Yes, but you know, we don't have time here. But if you do want to hear more on At the Movies, we reviewed it. So you know, if Shiraz plugging his Twitter account, you can download the episode of Wild Wild Country.
Okay.
Oh, I look forward to that. I didn't know you'd do.
Yeah, we did it about a month ago.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Okay, great. I've got like a secondhand Honda that I want to sell. So why don't I use the show for that? So
how much?
get in touch with me, we'll work it out. So we move on now, and only remains for me now to thank special honoured guest, returnee Sharad Kutan.
Always a pleasure.
And Uma Pagan, Umbike Pagan.
Always a pleasure.
Myself, Cam Rastlan. So please join the Twitter account of at Sharad Kutan.
Spelled SHARADKUTTAN.
Not Gerard Kitten, as much as many people think he is.
All right. And or myself at Cam Rastlan, not Karim Rastlan. And finally, our number one Twitter person here.
I'm just at Uma Pagan.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.